The most amazing thing, the creator of heaven and earth, the God who delivered them out of Egypt, declares that he's going to enter into a covenant with these people. It's not a contract. It's a kind of binding agreement between things which couldn't possibly have any relation to one another, save for this kind of device, something which binds together God and man in a promise forever.
Dr. Cass, in this final conversation, I think we should try to bring together some of the threads that we've opened up and see if we can encapsulate in one discussion the sum and substance of founding God's nation. To do that, I thought we could actually conclude our series by going back to the very beginning of your book. You open the book with a prefatory note from the 18th century Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And I wanted to read that and then ask you to comment on it.
Okay.
Here's what Rousseau writes. An astonishing and truly unique spectacle is to see an expatriated people who have had neither place nor land for nearly 2,000 years, a scattered people, dispersed over the world, enslaved, persecuted, scorned by all nations, nonetheless preserving its characteristics, its laws, its customs, its patriotic love of the early social union, when all ties with it seem broken. The Jews provide us with an astonishing spectacle. The laws of Numa, Lycurgus, Solon are dead. The very much older laws of Moses are still alive. Athens, Sparta, Rome have perished and no longer have children left on earth. Zion, destroyed, has not lost its children. Rousseau writes, "What must be the strength of legislation capable of working such wonders? Capable of braving conquests, dispersions, revolutions, exiles, capable of surviving the customs, laws, empire of all the nations, and which finally promises them by these trials that it is going to continue to sustain them all, to conquer the vicissitudes of things human, and to last as long as the world. Any man," he says, "whosoever he is, must acknowledge this as a unique marvel, the causes of which, divine or human, certainly deserve the study and admiration of the sages in preference to all that Greece and Rome offer of what is admirable in the way of political institutions and human settlements." Why'd you begin the book with that quotation?
Well, I found it rather late in the enterprise, but it seemed to me an astounding testimony of one of the world's most profound thinkers and a thinker about politics, in favor of the singularity and importance of the laws of Moses and of the teachings of the Book of Exodus as the core text of the founding of the Israelite nation of the Jewish people. And it was in search of the wisdom, precisely of that wisdom of this political founding, that I undertook the study of Exodus. And it was what I thought I was doing. And for the longest part, and we can talk about what else happened, but for the longest part of my time working on it was, in fact, what I was doing. As we said at the outset, I undertook to study this book, seeking its wisdom about what? About primarily the question, what makes a people a people? What constitutes its identity? What holds it together? What guides its life? To what does it look up? To what should it aspire? Those were the questions that I was interested in. It grew out of my studies of Genesis, where we saw how God's attempt to start a better way for human life found a foothold in the world in the patriarchal generations of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and how at the end of Genesis, the descendants of Jacob, now called Israel, have settled in Egypt on the threshold of becoming a sufficient multitude to consider themselves a people. And Exodus would be the place where peoplehood would take place, would be founded, and the political wisdom of the Hebrew Bible would be laid out before me. So that's the idea of Rousseau, and that's the idea of Cass starting out. I didn't know his injunction, but I was following it nonetheless.
So the one way to read Founding God's Nation is as an answer to Rousseau, who puts before us this question and this mystery, and in an attempt to try to substantiate what he has observed, you offer us this commentary. That's one way to read the text.
Yeah, and it's not a wrong way to read the text, because a large part of the book as written is still in the grip of that political philosophical question. I knew going in that the answer of the Hebrew Bible about what is a good life and what is a good human being and what is a good community are not going to be identical to the answers given by other political philosophers that I'd studied and admired and loved in the tradition, especially the Greeks, Plato and Aristotle. But I was still interested in that question and what the alternative answer was. And in a way, I'm not disappointed. But I would say one of the things that the book of Exodus showed me, against my original inclination, was that there are three and not merely two pillars on which the Israelite nation is being erected. Yes, there is a national story, a national narrative repeated annually. It is the heart of the Jewish memory. It's the story of once we were slaves in Egypt until the Lord brought us out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And that's the story of enslavement in Egypt and deliverance with lots of signs, wonders, and judgments. That's the first part. Every nation has a story about its ancestors, where it came from, how we got to be here. They don't all start in slavery, but the United States starts with an oppressive monarch, which we overthrew, et cetera, et cetera. Second, and I thought which was absolutely central, was the law. I mean, the way of Israel is the way of the Torah, of the law, given on Mount Sinai, not just the Ten Commandments, which are the principles of the law, but all of these ordinances, which we've talked about several times. What I never paid terribly much attention to and thought it was merely a concession to human weakness was the large last third of the book, which is about the tabernacle. The tabernacle, if the first is the national narrative that tells us where we came from and what we owe for our present time, and the law gives us our guidance for how we should live individually and in community, the last part, the tabernacle, answers to a kind of deep longing in the human soul to be in touch with what's highest, and to, in a way, answer to the restlessness in the soul for lack of such information, such knowledge, and such contact. So this is a piece of, I don't know whether Rousseau would share the enthusiasm for the importance of the last part, but he sent me to Exodus, or I was sent to Exodus, and I came away with something that's not dreamt of in the writings of my Greek friends.
If you'll permit an observation.
Please.
The political wisdom that you were searching for seems to have given way, especially in your interpretation of the tabernacle, into something more than political, so that as you read Exodus, it's not merely a book of political and social wisdom, but of something else. And that leads me to ask if somehow the text that you're reading, what the text says, is separate from the question of what the text is doing to the reader, and if it should move you in some particular way.
Let me take that, but I don't want to give the impression that there isn't a lot of political wisdom to be found here, political and moral wisdom. This is a kind of,
because yes.
It really is itself unique. This is not just a political wisdom which, after Hobbes, would be designed to keep the peace and prevent people from beating up on one another for their own advantage. The political teaching is already a moral teaching and is designed to lift people up beyond the mere necessities of civil peace and order. It's designed to address the things in their souls that weigh them down and that enslave them from within. We've talked about it on several occasions. So that even if you ignored the tabernacle and just looked at what's the content of this law, what is the genius of the Sabbath teaching and how it teaches a certain kind of human dignity and relief from toil and grasping and teaches gratitude? How honor your father and mother teaches reverence rather than insolence and is the medium of transmitting a way of life? How the law about coveting begins to address contentment in life and how to think in relation to your neighbors. The whole range of things, very special political and moral teachings, which shouldn't be somehow shunted aside because Cass eventually figured out that there's more going on here than politics. So with that said, I'm prepared to go on, but I do want that out here, and if you'd like, we could pursue it some more, either now or later. But look,
let's linger on that for a moment, then.
Okay.
Doubtless, there will be. We'll come back to this question of what else is happening in the text, but without a doubt, there will be some viewers of ours who have been inspired by their study of political ideas and political philosophy. And in the American context that we're speaking in, the Hebrew Bible is not often taught in survey courses of the history of political philosophy. Is that a mistake?
It's not a treatise, and it doesn't have chapters on a separation of powers or balance of consent of the governed and things of that sort. Its wisdom is contained in a story, and you have to enucleate it. And in fact, it doesn't teach by argument. It teaches by showing. And it also teaches, as you've hinted already, by working on the reader, to which we'll return. But it is important because it has a vision of the common good and of the common life that is more than minimal. And it deals with the formation of a people, not just in order to secure their rights, but to make them the kind of people who can actually exercise the large responsibilities of self-governance, not only governing themselves politically, but governing themselves within their own souls and in their own families. So that, if I'm, for example, in American political thought class teaching Tocqueville, and I read early on in Tocqueville where he marvels at America because in America, unlike in Europe, the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty are friends. And then I begin to wonder, where in the Constitution of the United States do we get anything like the spirit of religion, where we have instead institutional arrangements to provide the defect of the absence of great men of virtue all the time? You remind yourself that America was, in addition to being a liberal political regime, was actually a Christian country in which the teachings of the Bible were the formation of the souls of human beings in families, social, in communities, socially. And that part of the genius of America now, I think, with a balance shifted very much into demanding our rights and very little about knowing our duties, could benefit from having an account of what political life would mean if people were in fact summoned to the higher possibilities of their nature.
And now just taking a step into that, there are certain natural problems, natural intellectual problems, prejudices of our time that make it hard for students studying Aristotle to understand him. But there must be problems that make it hard for us to understand this text too.
Oh, look, it's very hard to understand this text. It's looks like a text of an ancient people in circumstances very different from our own. Yes, there are their descendants who are still alive and read this book in the synagogue every week, going through it once a year. But a lot of the customs are archaic. Some of the practices are downright offensive to modern sensibilities. And what American liberal wants to take moral lessons from this ancient desert people with a god who thunders mightily and tells them what to do. But like any book, any great book, if you park your prejudices at the door and decide you're going to submit to the experience of reading this book and try to find out what it says, what it means, how somebody in his right mind could have written this and thought this, and then only then begin to ask the question, could this be true? And if it was true, what difference might it make? Then all kinds of books that we will throw away from the beginning if we think that we don't want to read them because they don't provide ammunition for opinions we already hold, we can learn a lot from the great books. And it was really in the great books tradition, teaching books in the great books tradition, that I started on this book. And I found to my astonishment that if I suspended disbelief and I decided to take a walk with the book and see what it had to teach me, that I might learn some things about things I cared about, which I might not learn from any other book, which is what I always recommend to my students, whether they like it or not. If they're in the class, they're there voluntarily. I mean, they've come because they want to read this book with me. And it's always gone well, whatever their starting obstacles are. And there have been believers and non-believers and Buddhists and Hindus and Sikhs. And everybody gets into it.
Okay. Getting into it might mean learning what the book says.
Right.
Okay. But it might be that, as you've suggested in various places in the book, the book has a way of doing its work on you beyond merely what it says. And it, in effect, does something to the reader.
Yep.
Could you describe what that is?
Let me say something about it in general, and then if you'd like, I might be willing to say something particular about what this book has done to me. I've almost said what I mean about what a book does. Books say the same things over and over again. The people who come to it are not the same. And if you come to a book more than once in your life, you're not going to be the same person. And a book that you might have thought was just stupid or silly when you were stupid and silly, you discover later on has wonderful things to teach you about the things that matter. I taught Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics every other year for 20 weeks, 4 hours a week. And I read it as an undergraduate, and I couldn't stand it. I thought it was boring. I was just too shallow to benefit from it. So I tell the students, we're not here just to learn about this book. We're going to try to live with it and learn from it. Now, learning from it might mean internalizing the things that it says if you find it true. So that's not quite yet what it means to say the book works on you. But books do have deeds. And if you go into a book with your whole heart and soul, with your imagination identifying with the characters, with allowing yourself to see what it would be like to experience those things or to engage in the conversations and take each person's part, it turns out that you are a kind of silent participant in the whole story. You're not just a disembodied viewer, but you become an engaged participant. It's the place that I first learned how to do this was in reading Platonic dialogues, which the British philosophers just read as bad logical arguments. They neglect the drama of the thing. But like in every living conversation, people not only say things that have a manifest logical content, but they're incited to speak for their reasons, so that there's a logical and a psychological and interpersonal aspect. And if you want to understand a conversation, including this one, you have to think about who's talking and why, and if I give you a chance to speak, why you're speaking. In other words, you have to vivify as a living experience what you read. And if you can do that sympathetically, it turns out that unbeknownst to you, that experience of sympathetically entering into the text in with the double vision of being the characters and also from the narrator's point of view back and forth, it turns out that as a result of living with a book a long time, talking about it with people who see it differently than you, it works on you. It does things to you that you don't know have happened to you until some later time.
Would you be willing to share with us the things that the book has caused to happen to you?
Yeah, well, I would say we start with the simple things and work to the more profound things. The simple thing we already discussed in the last session, where I started reading this book and the name of God appears on the first page of Genesis. And without even arresting myself, I said, well, I know who they're talking about. And I would read continuously as if the name of God or the name Lord always meant the same thing, some immutable, eternal, omniscient, all of that. And it took a long time to realize, and it took finally, God's half-revelation to Moses, in which those attributes are not mentioned, but other ones, his mercy and so on, mentioned, that I had no right on the principle that I've adopted to read, namely, put everything else you know out of mind. Don't bring alien concepts into this book. Allow the book to teach you how it means to be read, through what vehicles of instruction. The book doesn't want me to ask the question, does God exist? The book doesn't want me to import my distinction between what's ethical and what's merely ritual, which is very traditionally understood. They're the ethical teachings of the Bible, and then the sacrifices or the observances of the holidays, mere ritual. A text doesn't make that distinction. The ordinances are one sweep, one package. Why is that? Business about the names. You get an answer to a name that's evasive and that, in fact, as we talked about in the last session, says, don't try to capture my essence as if the name was the road to an idea, but pay attention to what I say and do, in which I will manifest myself in a way that you will understand and get to know. So a different way of knowing, a way of thinking that the political question of liberation was not what the story is primarily about, but the whole liberation is, in fact, for coming to understand something about what governs in this world. And all of these are new questions that I acquired because the text forced me to have those questions. If you read quickly and you don't slow down, you'll just assimilate the reading to your preformed preconceptions. But if you slow down and you read with smart young students who ask hard questions, you eventually destabilize what you've brought to the text, and you allow it to show you different ways of learning, different concepts with which you need to work. It's hard to get rid of everything you know, but if you do it long enough, you begin to inhabit that world. And I'm very comfortable in this world now. I mean, I walk on the street sometimes and I wonder, oh, it's not out here in the desert and there's actually water. By inhabiting the world, I acquire different experiences. I get different ideas of what it means to know something or how to learn something. I learn something very different about leadership than I thought going in.
What's that?
I learned something about, I originally thought that the crucial thing about Moses was his character and what is revealed in those early episodes. Moses, a man of immense fellow feeling and a passion for righteousness, who is a man of action. I didn't notice to begin with that that accomplished very little, that Moses had to learn prudence, that Moses, in fact, more important to becoming Moses was that Moses was actually curious, and Moses actually had a kind of theological orientation not yet formulated, and that, but that his way of trying to make his way in the world, either on the basis of character through deeds, or on the basis of speech and argument, or on the basis of God knows what, not adequate. That there was something else that a neat leader needed to learn. I never noticed, for example, that the problem that he was so great that he had contempt for the very people he led, and what it took for him to actually embrace them in a way many an aristocratic leader never embraces the people that they need to lead. I mean, all kinds of things that are that are there. I never would have thought, for example, that episode where after the golden calf, when Moses divides the camp and they kill 3,000 men, I originally thought, well, it must have been the guilty people and everybody knew who was responsible, and saw this was an act of necessary constructive violence which went against the grain and stuck in my throat, but I had to wrestle with it.
In framing the book out of your own experience, as you have, as a teacher, among the most distinguished teachers of the great books of the West, you have now had something to say to people who are primarily formed outside of religious traditionalism, right, and outside of religious orthodoxies. People who are coming to the book naive and are comfortable with the wisdom-seeking spirit with which you read the book. What do you have to say to traditionally Christian and Jewish readers of the text, for whom we're not, for whom this is, in addition to that kind of wisdom, also Holy Scripture?
Yeah. Look, I have, and I, it hasn't come across in these conversations sufficiently, but I venture these speculations of mine, obviously with zeal and passion, but with acute awareness that my readings are often non-traditional, although I'm very pleased to discover when religious people write me and say, this is actually what some rabbi said, or this is what the Talmud said, or Christian readers write me and with encouragement. I have enormous regard for the traditions, Jewish and Christian, and the people for whom this book is not just a great book, but a guide to their life and informs the way they've seen the world from childhood or from conversion or what have you. I think I read the text with great reverence. I think every word counts. But I also think that one's appreciation of the things that one has been taught from the tradition, and even the appreciation of the laws that the tradition makes binding on its adherents, that the appreciation of that can only be deepened by reflection. Being obedient, it does not require having a lobotomy. And Moses himself says in Deuteronomy to the children of Israel, this is your wisdom in the eyes of the nation. Any people hearing your laws and statutes will say, this is a wise and discerning nation. So I think we have, even from the Torah itself, the suggestion that even for people on whom this is not binding, and therefore all the more for the people on whom it's binding, that its wisdom can be enhanced, deepened by study. And by all means, I mean, study in the traditional way, but perhaps there's something here that could add to it. And certainly there's nothing in here that ought to give anybody, I have neither intent nor do I think I've put anything in here that certainly intentionally means to weaken people's attachment or their piety or their observance.
Dr. Kass, in the earliest passages of the book, as indeed in other things that you've written and published, you tell the story of your earliest formation in a non-traditionally religious household, a secular Jewish household, a Yiddish-speaking household, in which this text was not part of the daily study of the home. You subsequently built a career, built a life dedicated to both the teaching and learning of great books and the advancement of a certain kind of natural science, and came to this as a kind of late thinking and late development in your own career. Now, I wonder if, understanding what you understand now, you could give some counsel to your younger selves of how they might treat this book and the role that it might play.
Oh, that's hard to do, John. Every younger self has their own path to follow. I can say something about my own, and also about how in the process, to my surprise, the book worked on me in more than political ways, which was a question we left hanging. I was raised in a Yiddish-speaking household. My parents were immigrants on first-generation America. We had, in the Yiddish school that I went, what was called the third Seder, the third Passover Seder. We had a Yiddish Haggadah in which the hero of the story is Moses, and the name of God is barely mentioned, and maybe not even mentioned at all. It's a kind of Yiddish-speaking socialist Haggadah of the world made new after the Second World War. Little did they know. And I loved that. But it was culture. I had the moral teachings, some of the moral teachings, especially about family life and so on, that were derivative on the Jewish tradition. But it was really, and certain teachings about righteousness and so on, the Jewish prophets without the law, but without books. I mean, just as handed down through the experience of my very wonderful parents, wonderful human beings. Look, I started teaching these books because my wife and I designed a course on human being and citizen at the University of Chicago, and we thought the Bible ought to, the Jewish and Christian Bibles ought to have representatives. So I taught Genesis and Exodus. She taught Matthew in the middle of a year-long course, and these stories got a hold of me. And I took them to the dinner table, and we would talk about the stories of Genesis endlessly. And eventually I got up enough nerve to teach these things, thinking I wouldn't do anybody any harm, even though my Jewish practice was not great. Actually, I leave out something very important, which turns out to be, it gives me the willies. My closest friend, Harvey Flaminoff, the tutor at St. John's College, was always teasing me about my Yiddishkeit, that it was parasitic on traditional Judaism and it couldn't survive in America. All those Yiddish speakers were gone. The cultural milieu Hitler took care of, it wasn't going to come back. And when our first child was born, he told me, he says, look, he says, why don't you come with me to Hillel? We were living in Cambridge at the time. Come, you'll come for Sabbath services. You know, they read the Torah. They read a portion of the Bible, and then somebody's going to get up and say something interesting about it. And you like discussions of texts, you might learn something. So in February 1967, I went with him, and the text of the week happened to be the beginning of the instructions for building the tabernacle, among the most boring passages in the whole thing. And I'm 27 years old, I'm a wise guy sitting there saying to myself, let's see somebody make something interesting out of this. And the rabbi got up and he says, you know, this story of the golden, of this tabernacle is going to be repeated a little later when they build it according to these instructions. But in the middle, there's the story of the golden calf. And by the way, the tabernacle exists because of this problem that you see with the golden calf. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, somebody's going to make something good. I'm giving you the short version. Something that good about this boring chapter. Maybe there's something here. And when we moved 6 months later to Bethesda, my wife and I joined a congregation on the belief that our children deserve to have an education in something rather than nothing. And that my intuition was that our something was nothing to be ashamed of. We began to light the Sabbath candles. The practice was halting, but we did go on the Saturday to services and so on and have for a good part of life. Anyhow, that experience, first time hearing the Torah read, and then the experience back in Chicago where we started teaching the great books, and these texts became just powerful for me, and I couldn't shake them. And then I finally decided it didn't matter that I wasn't a Bible scholar, and it didn't matter that I couldn't pretend to be a proper representative of observant Judaism. I was somewhere, but I couldn't be. But that students like myself might benefit from the benefit I was getting from reading these books seriously, reading them the way I would read Aristotle's Ethics or Plato's Republic or Rousseau's Discourse on Inequality or Darwin's Origin of Species or other great texts. So I began to do it. And I think 20 years teaching Genesis, another overlapping 20 years teaching Exodus. And I had tremendous students from whom I learned a lot. They were willing to enter into the spirit of reading the book for its wisdom, to challenge things, to try to understand it in its own terms. And as I say, it has worked a lot on me. The place it's worked on me the most, and the thing that was the greatest surprise, and this comes back to the deed of Exodus, has to do with the tabernacle. And it comes sort of in two forms. I never, as I say, never paid it much attention. I heard this story in the synagogue in 1967. I filed away that view of what the tabernacle was. It was a concession to human Dionysiac wildness. But if you're writing a commentary on the whole book of Exodus, who are you to say that the last third of it isn't as important as the first two thirds? And I was doing it in the company of some good friends who knew the stuff pretty well. And we just went line by line through it. And I began to see that there's more here than just concessive, and it's more here than just politics, that people in the story do have a kind of spiritual hunger, and that the tabernacle, as we said in the last session, has something to do with the completion of life. That being in touch with the highest things might actually answer to certain restlessness of an old man. I was capable of idolatry too in other forms, and that might repose one's trust in things that might not ultimately stand. And that then, because I try to imagine myself in the text, and I've read this story about the tabernacle being built, what am I supposed to do but imagine myself among the, I've been with the people in various other places. I've been with them in Egypt. I've been with them at Sinai. I've been with them at the calf. Now they've put the tabernacle up. I'll go inside. I'll see what it feels like. I imagine myself in the place. I'm in there with the congregants, thousands of them. The place is built not by Frank Lloyd Wright, but the blueprint is given by the Almighty. And the Holy of Holies contains a golden ark. I can't see it, but the high priest, he's going to minister to it once a year. The Holy of Holies contains the Ark of the Covenant, which contains the law that we were given and that I consented to with everybody else. And here we've come to this place surrounded by the things of God's provision. As a community, centered here, offering our offerings of contrition or gratitude, raising our voices in song and in prayer and in blessing. And the question is, do I feel some kind of experience that I'm encountering something that has not been dreamt of in my philosophizing? It didn't hurt that in the latter part of my life, really since my wife passed away, I've been attending a congregation here in Washington where every so often, because of the remarkable spirit in that congregation and the remarkable singing, I've had something of a glimpse of what it would mean to be in touch with something beyond. I don't dare give it a name because the name isn't important. But I'm lifted outside of myself and feel somehow fuller, higher, more complete. And it's an astounding thing to happen to an old guy, I'll tell you.
Dr. Cass, of course, is also perhaps relevant, or I should ask if it's relevant. I know that though having spent much of your life in Chicago and in Washington, D.C., in the last many years, you've spent part of the year, each year, studying, teaching, learning in Jerusalem. And I wonder if that experience at all shaped the writing of the text.
It did shape the writing of the text, and again, in ways that were completely unanticipated. The first year I went over there, 2016, I was asked to teach a course on the book of Exodus, on which I had been at work, to second-year students at Shalem College, Israel's only four-year liberal arts college. The students were reading the text in the original Hebrew. I was teaching in English with Robert Alter's translation. The experience was frustrating for them. Only about a third of them could express themselves fully in English. I would wind up saying, "So speak in Hebrew and someone will translate." And it was frustrating. My way of reading wasn't their habitual way. These were religious kids, non-religious kids. But through the entire experience, I couldn't shake this overwhelming feeling that here I was in my late 70s, having the privilege of teaching in Jerusalem the founding text of the Jewish people to noble young Israelis, all of whom had finished their national service, were dedicated to their country, a country which had been reborn in my lifetime. They're speaking a language that was never spoken on the street in 2,000 years till about 120 years before. And that here we were talking together about the text that helped them survive those 2,000 years in exile and was still, as Rousseau says, a text that would look like it was a people that might survive till the end of time. I just couldn't shake the feeling that there was something at work here that was beyond my understanding. It would seem to me that even an atheist in my shoes would have to say, this is a miracle.
Well, for taking us, your readers, by the hand and giving us a tour through the constitutive memory of the Exodus, and then beyond that to the law-giving at Sinai, answering some of what Rousseau had in mind, and then finally allowing us to accompany you into the construction of the tabernacle. Leon Cass, I'm so grateful for what you've taught us and for helping us understand all of the intricacies and mystery that we stand before in trying to understand the founding of God's nation.
Thank you very much, John. Pleasure to be with you.